94. Always caught off guard. In the special prison, too, it was time for breakfast and morning tea. The day began with no warning that it was to be in any way special. It was notable to begin with only for the captiousness of Lieutenant Schusterman. He was getting ready to go off duty, and did his best to prevent prisoners from sleeping after reveille. The exercise period, too, went badly. An overnight frost had followed yesterday's thaw, and a thin crust of ice had formed on the well-trodden paths. Many of the Zacks emerged from their quarters, made one circuit, slithering on the ice, and went back inside. In their cells, Zacks sat on their bunks, those up above with the legs tucked under them or dangling, none of them in any hurry to get up, scratching their chests, yawning, making an early start with the usual dreary jokes against one another or about their wretched fate, and, of course, telling one another their dreams, a favourite prison pastime. But although someone had dreamed of crossing a bridge over a turbid stream, and someone else of pulling on high boots, no one's dream had foretold transportation en masse. Sir Logdin, as usual, went out early to chop wood. He had kept the window ajar through the night, and he opened it wide before leaving for the woodpile. Reuben, who lay with his head toward the same window, exchanged not a single word with Sir Logdin. He had gone to bed late the night before, had again been unable to sleep, and felt now a cold draught from the window, but, not wishing to interfere with the offender's proceedings, he put on his fur cap with ear flaps and his padded jacket, lay curled up with his head under the covers, did not get up for breakfast, and ignored the admonitions of Schusterman and the general noise in the room, doing his best to prolong the hours of sleep. Potapov was one of the first to rise. He had taken his walk, was among the earliest breakfasters, had already drunk his tea and straightened his bed, and was sitting reading the paper, but secretly longing to get to work. He was going to calibrate an interesting apparatus that he had made himself. Breakfast was millet mush. Many prisoners stayed away. Gerasimovich, on the contrary, lingered in the dining room, slowly and carefully inserting small quantities of gruel into his mouth. A casual onlooker would never have taken him for the theorist of a palace revolution. Nerzhin looked at him from the opposite corner of the half-empty dining room, and wondered whether he had given the right answer the night before. To doubt is to be conscientious in the quest for knowledge, but was there a limit beyond which the doubter should not retreat? If free speech ceased to exist everywhere in the world, if the Times obediently reproduced Pravda, if the natives on the Zambezi subscribed to the state loan, if collective farmers on the Loire bent their backs for kolkhoz wages, if party hogs took their holidays behind 10 fences in the gardens of California, would life still be worth living? How long could you shirk decisions with a don't know? Nerzhin listlessly finished his breakfast and climbed into his upper bunk to spend his last 15 free minutes lying down and looking at the domed ceiling. What had happened to Ruska was still the subject of discussion in the room. He had not returned for the night and had obviously been arrested. Prison HQ contained a small, dark cell, and he must have been locked up there. They didn't come straight out with it, didn't openly call him a double-crosser, but that was what they implied. The gist of what they said was that nothing could be tacked on to his sentence, but maybe they'd convert 25 years of labour camp to 25 years solitary. That year new prisons were being built with single-prisoner cells, and solitary was becoming more and more fashionable. Shikin, of course, could not be charging him with double-dealing, but the charge brought against a man and his actual offence did not necessarily coincide. If he was tow-headed, you could accuse him of black-headedness, and give him just as long a sentence. Gleb did not know how far things had gone between Ruska and Clara, and whether he ought to or would have the courage to comfort her. And if so, how? Reuben threw off his blanket, and, to laughter all around, appeared in his fur cap and padded jacket. Laughter at his own expense, he never took amiss. Ridicule of socialism was what he could not stand. He removed his cap but kept his jacket on, and did not lower his feet to the floor to get dressed. There was little point in it now that he had missed exercise, ablutions, and breakfast, but asked someone to pour him a glass of tea and sat in bed, with his beard dishevelled, absently popping bits of buttered white bread into his mouth and washing it down with the hot liquid, while with half-open eyes he lost himself in Upton Sinclair's novel, holding it with the same hand beside his glass. He was in the blackest of moods. Morning inspection was now in progress. The junior lieutenant was deputizing. He counted heads while Schusterman made announcements. Entering the semicircular room, Schusterman called out, as he had in the others before it,
"Attention! Prisoners are informed that after supper no one will be allowed into the kitchen to get hot water. The duty officer must not be knocked for and called out for this purpose."
"Whose order is that?"
Prianchikov yelled furiously, jumping out of a cave formed by placing two double bunks together.
"The commandant's," Schusterman answered importantly.
"When was it made?"
"Yesterday."
Prianchikov raised his skinny arms and brandished his fists above his head as though calling heaven and earth to witness.
"That cannot be right," he protested. "Last Saturday evening, Minister Abakumov in person promised to me that there would be hot water at night. It stands to reason. After all, we work till 12 at night."
A peal of laughter from the prisoners was his answer.
"So don't work till 12, you prick,"
Dvaitsyosov boomed.
"We can't employ a night cook,"
Schusterman explained reasonably. Then, taking the list from the hands of the junior lieutenant, he called out in an overbearing voice that reduced them all to silence,
"Attention! The following will not report for work, but will get themselves ready for transportation. From your room, Karabrov, Mikhailov, Nyerzhin, Shomushkin, have items of prison issue ready to hand in."
With this, the inspection party left the room, leaving the four whose names had been called out as if a tornado had caught them. People abandoned their tea and bread and butter and hurriedly formed little groups, some of them around those due to depart. 4 out of 25. An unusually large cull. They all started talking at once, excited voices, lowered voices, dismissively cheerful voices. Some of them stood upright on upper bunks, waving their arms. Some clutched their heads. Some held forth excitedly, beating their breasts. Some were already shaking the pillows out of their pillowcases. And altogether the room presented such a chaotic medley of grief, submissiveness, resentment, resolution, lamentation, and speculation, all of this crammed into a confined space and on several different levels, that Rubin rose from his bed just as he was, in his padded jacket and underpants, and yelled,
"A historic day for the special prison! Morning of the execution of the Streltsy!"
spreading his arms out wide over the general scene. His excitement certainly did not mean that he was happy to see men transported. He would have found it just as funny if he had to leave himself. If he saw a chance to make a joke, nothing was sacred. Transportation is an event as momentous in the life of a prisoner as being wounded is in the life of a soldier. And, just as a wound may be light or serious, curable or fatal, so transportation may be to somewhere close or somewhere distant. It may be a diversion, and it may mean death. When you read about the alleged horrors of penal servitude in Tsarist times, as described by Dostoevsky, you are amazed to find how tranquilly men were allowed to serve out their sentences. They could go for 10 years without being transported once. A Zek lives in one and the same place, gets used to his comrades, his work, his masters. However unacquisitive he is, he inevitably accumulates possessions. He finds himself the owner of a fiber suitcase sent from outside or one made of plywood in the camp. He acquires a little frame in which he puts a photograph of his wife or daughter, rag slippers that he puts on to walk about the hut after work and hides from inspection during the daytime. He may even have pinched an extra pair of cotton trousers or hung on to his old shoes instead of handing them in. And all this moves from one hiding place to another after every stock taking. He even has his own needle, buttons sewn on securely, and a couple more in reserve. There is usually tobacco in his pouch. If he is a square, he will also have a supply of tooth powder and occasionally clean his teeth. This prisoner accumulates a stack of letters from his family, and usually has a book of his own to exchange with others, so that he gets to read every book in the camp. But transportation strikes like a bolt from the blue to destroy his little life, always without warning, always contrived to take the Zek unawares and at the last possible moment. Then letters from loved ones are torn up and dropped into the hole of the latrine. And then the escort, if transportation is to be in red cattle trunks, cuts off all the Zex buttons and sprinkles his tobacco and tooth powder on the breeze, since they might be used to blind one of the guards in the course of the journey. If transportation is to be in locked passenger train cars, the escort guard stamps furiously on cases that refuse to go into the baggage compartment, smashing the photograph frame while he is at it. In either case, they take away the books, not allowed on the journey, and the needle, which might be used to saw through bars and stab a guard. The rag slippers are thrown away as trash, and the spare pair of breeches confiscated for general camp use. And, purged of the sin of property ownership, of his predilection for a settled life, of his hankering after petty bourgeois comfort, justly stigmatized by Chekhov all those years ago, deprived of his friends and his past, the Zek puts his hands behind his back and in columns of four,
one step to the right or one step to the left, and the escort guard opens fire without warning.
Surrounded by dogs and guards, walks toward the car. You have all seen him on our railroad stations at that moment, but have faint-heartedly lowered your eyes in a hurry, loyally turned away, in case the lieutenant in charge of the convoy suspects you of something and arrests you. The Zek enters the carriage or truck, and it is hitched on so that it stands alongside a mail truck. Tightly caged in on all sides, invisible from the platforms, he travels according to a leisurely timetable, carrying with him in that airless, confined space hundreds of memories, hopes, and apprehensions. Where are they taking him? They aren't saying. What awaits the prisoner in his new place? The copper mines? A lumber camp? Or a coveted reassignment to an agricultural working party, where he may sometimes be lucky enough to bake a potato and can eat his fill of the cattle's turnips? Will the prisoner be laid low by scurvy or malnutrition after 1 month on general assignment? Or will he be lucky enough to grease a palm or meet somebody he knows, and latch on to a barrack orderly's or hospital orderly's or even storeroom assistant's job? And will they allow him to write and receive letters in his new place? Or will his letters be intercepted year after year, until his loved ones write him off as dead? But perhaps he won't even reach his appointed destination. Perhaps he will die in the cattle wagon. Of dysentery? Or because they are kept on the move for 6 days without bread? Or perhaps the guards will beat him to death with hammers because someone else has made his escape? Or maybe at the end of the journey in a freight car with an unheated stove, the Zeks will be frozen stiff and their bodies slung out like so much firewood? It takes the red trains a month to reach Sovgarden. Remember, O Lord, those who did not arrive. Those leaving were treated leniently, even allowed to keep their razors as far as the first prison, but all these questions tormented the 20 prisoners detailed for transportation during the Tuesday morning room inspection. For them, the untroubled, half-free life of the special prison was over.